Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Is Our Children Learning? When we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush said that what Americans wanted, though, was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. They all recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not measured in jobs, 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 and that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales, not in public business, and it's certainly not in jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I cashed in on our inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the old covenant contract in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on my CD, Homeschool for Adults, and while you're at it, order my free general law CD package at the same time. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, George Bush has a lot of detractors. One of them is a fellow by the name of Paul Begala, spelled B-E-G-A-L-A, who wrote a book called Is Our Children Learning? With George Bush on the cover. It's a hilarious book. It's, in my view, as good as anything that you're going to read in humor, especially when you think of Yogi Berra. You know, there's some neat lines that George Bush comes up with from time to time. He said, for instance, at the Greater Nashua, New Hampshire Chamber of Commerce back in January of 2000, he said, "I know how hard it is for you to put food on your families." And he said, quoted in the New York Times in February of 2000, George Bush said, "I think we need not only to eliminate the toll booth to the middle class, I think we should knock down the toll booth." I didn't see as much humor in that one as I did the first one, but George Bush and Yogi Berra are two peas in a pod, and I can associate myself with both of them. I can identify with both of them because I talk just about like they do, you know, with split infinitives and double negatives, and the syntax is wrong, and tenses are out of joint, and, you know, hey, what do you expect from a good old farm boy? Mr. Begala took on George Bush, though, on a number of subjects, such as education, Social Security, unions, minimum wage. There are a number of chapters in here, and I thought, well, maybe I should shut up about politics, but after all, politics is one of the things that we review here on the Law Hour, an editorial review. And besides that, I think a little humor is good for all of us. If you're a Democrat, you'll love the book because it agrees with everything that you believe. You can't go wrong with, is our children learning? If you're a Republican, you'll love it. You'll identify with George Bush like you've never identified with him before. And if you're an independent, and you're not of any particular political persuasion, you'll love the book for the humor. That's what I am. I'm an independent, and I just love it for the humor. So I'm going to take chapter 9, where it says, why help working families when you can suck up to the wealthy families? I thought, well, that sounds pretty good, so I got my pencil out and I sharpened it on both ends so that I could take notes. Listen to this. Mr. Bogala starts by saying, perhaps because he's never held an honest job, that is to say a job that he didn't get because of his family's name or his father's contacts, George W. Bush has a remarkably consistent record of opposing anything and everything that could help working people. His attitude seems to be, I made a fortune with nothing but a trust fund and a father in the White House. Why can't you? And on issues of working families, Bush promises a return, not just to the 1980s when Ronald Reagan told us ketchup was a vegetable, but all the way back to the 1930s. His positions today are virtually indistinguishable from Herbert Hoover's. Think about this. Well, that's the opening paragraph to Chapter 9, and I thought, gosh, you mean to tell me that ketchup isn't a vegetable? Well, that just goes to show you how much I know. And Ronald Reagan and Bush's Vice President Quayle, remember, Quayle couldn't spell potato, and Ronald Reagan didn't know that ketchup wasn't a vegetable. Isn't that just special? Well, now you know. I don't know what ketchup is, but we now know it's not a vegetable, don't we? Well, notice by the tone of voice here that Mr. Bogala doesn't care much for George Bush or his privileged position in life. But I thought that just because you're privileged, like John Kerry, I mean, you know, John Kerry, this is talking about the election of 2000, you know, John Kerry, wasn't he kind of privileged too? I mean, I thought he had about 7 or 8 houses. And I thought that he was married to a woman with $500 million. And I thought John Kerry was a multimillionaire and that he was kind of an upper crust liberal Eastern establishmentarian. And how about Al Gore? Was he a self-made millionaire? You know, there's a lot of people in politics, and there have been through the years, like Franklin D. Roosevelt. Roosevelt is a champion of liberal Democrats. Franklin Roosevelt came from a very privileged and wealthy family background, too, didn't he? I'm always surprised when I hear somebody pick somebody out and then criticize him when they don't offer the same criticism to others. Now, Bill Clinton came from poor background. So did Richard Nixon. So when you pick on George Bush and you say, well, he came from a wealthy, privileged background, and he's a no good, good-for-nothing politician, well, shouldn't we be honest and fair and say, well, John Kennedy came from a wealthy, privileged background, and he never did a day's work in his life. And his father was the ambassador to Great Britain, and he was a wealthy, suck-up Eastern liberal establishmentarian. But I don't hear him make the comparison with Democrats. I don't think that's fair, Paul. I think if you're going to single Bush out for being a suck-up privileged, you ought to identify at least one or two Democrats that, well, they do it too. Now, once in a while, you'll find a guy like Andrew Jackson. But not very often, Paul. Now, in paragraph 2, he says, Bush opposes a minimum wage law. Well, let's see what he has to say. He says, trying to have it both ways, Bush says that he supports an increase in the federal minimum wage. But only if states could opt out. That's a condition that could render a proposed increase meaningless, according to the Associated Press. This country has had a national minimum wage since the 1930s, but by allowing states to opt out, Bush would gut the minimum wage. States would be forced into a race to the bottom, in which they would first opt out of the national minimum wage, then reduce their state-based minimum wage in order to attract businesses. The pressure to cut the minimum wage would be tremendous. If states had the power to ignore the national minimum wage, there would be no such thing as a minimum wage in this country, exactly what Bush's powerful corporate supporters want. Well, I agree with you, Paul. I think that these powerful corporate supporters should be ignored in the equation. What I couldn't understand is, why is the government involved in the setting of wages and prices? Richard Nixon tried it. We did it back during World War II. The setting of wages and prices is a socialist and a communist philosophy and ideology. It wasn't written into our Constitution. They tried it in Cuba, China, and North Korea. Cuba and North Korea both have backward economies, and they're as poor as church mice. China tried it, and it didn't work for them, so they went to laissez-faire economics. And have you noticed how the Chinese economy is growing without wage and price controls in a free market environment at 7% a year, and everybody in the world is complaining about it? I just got to thinking, Paul, could it be that if we were to remove the constraints on the American economy, you know, like OSHA, the EPA, and got rid of all of these governmental programs that restrict American business, do you think maybe our economy would grow faster and produce more? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there for your consideration. I know we're not going to do that, and I know that I'm in a minority, but I thought I'd suggest it because in America, between 1787 and 1900, America became the wealthiest, most powerful, politically and economically and militarily, the country that was envied by everybody in the world, as evidenced by the fact that the poorest people in the world flocked to America without any minimum wage. And they thrived, and they prospered, and by 1950, Paul, we were the wealthiest nation in the world, the world's number one producer nation, and the world's number one creditor nation. Over the last 50 years, with the minimum wage and the socialist programs in place, we have now become the world's number one debtor nation, and we are no longer the world's number one producer nation in any of the 15 leading economic indicators of industrial production. I'm not sure that George Bush's opposition to minimum wage is all that bad. I'm opposed to it. I don't think minimum wage was a good idea, and I don't think it's a good idea today. In the period from 1787 to 1900, when we didn't have a minimum wage, America had its greatest growth spurt in our history. After 1900, we began to experiment in communist and socialist philosophies and practices. Things didn't go very well after 1900, and after 1933, they got worse and worse. Now, Paul goes on and he says, "Oh, Bagala," you may be thinking, "Bush seems like such a nice guy. I'll bet he'd support a strong minimum wage in his state." One word, wrong. Texas does not have, or does have, a minimum wage of $3.35 an hour. I'm sorry, Texas does have a minimum wage. It's $3.35 an hour. Six bills to increase the Texas minimum wage have been introduced since Bush took office. He didn't support any of them. In fact, he actively opposed raising the state minimum wage, and none of them passed. Well, let me ask you this, boys and girls. Let's think about this for a minute. Let's suppose minimum wage is a good idea. And I heard Ted Kennedy the other day. He said that in order to have a minimum wage where poor people could support their families, we'd have to have a minimum wage of $8 an hour. Minimum. Well, if $8 an hour is good, wouldn't $16 an hour be even gooder? Hey, let's think about this for a minute. If government, through the police power, can set the minimum wage at $5 and then raise it to $8, which is what Ted Kennedy is proposing, it must be because an extra $3 an hour in the minimum wage would be good for the poor, for the economy, for business, for consumers. Hell, it would be good for everybody, wouldn't it? So I'm simply asking the question, you know, I'm not a politician, I'm not an economist, but I'm just a Joe Sixpack out here, and I'm saying, well, if minimum wage is good, I didn't think that it was, but maybe I'm wrong. And if minimum wage is good at $8 an hour, can you imagine how good it would be, how much better it would be, how much more fantastic things would be if it was $16 an hour? So I'm in favor of raising the minimum wage to $16 an hour. And anybody that doesn't pay it ought to be shot at sunrise. Now, let's put a capital felony attached to the non-payment of minimum wage at $16 an hour. Now, what do you think that's going to do to the price of a Big Mac? What do you think that's going to do to the price of a hotel or a motel room? What do you think that's going to do to the price of carrots and onions and rutabagas in the produce section of your supermarket? You know, so somebody says, okay, so there's going to be some raises in price or rises in price. Okay, well, isn't that called inflation? Now, you know, we tested something like that, or very similar to it, with what's known as NAFTA. Remember? NAFTA? President Clinton supported that, and he said, tell you what, we gotta have free trade. And so, there was a little guy from Texas, do you remember his name, Ross Perot? Well, Ross Perot stood up and he said, wait a minute, this is dumb, this is stupid, this NAFTA is a race to the bottom. We don't want that. We want to protect Americans' jobs here in America. And President Bush says, well, listen, it's going to open up exports and it's going to do all these wonderful things and it's going to make life wonderful for us. So they enacted NAFTA. Now, down in South Florida, they had a pretty thriving tomato business. Yeah, American tomatoes grown in America, sold in American supermarkets and stores. Well, you see, the workers in the United States have to be paid minimum wage, and I believe it was around $5 an hour. Well, when they passed the NAFTA bill, it lowered the trade barrier between Mexican tomatoes and the U.S. border. So now you can grow tomatoes in Hermosillo, Mexico with $2 an hour Mexican labor, and you don't have to pay the $5 an hour American labor down in South Florida. What happened to the tomato industry in South Florida? It disappeared. It's gone. It's kaput. It's out of business. That's why I didn't think minimum wage was such a good idea. So, let's carry that through one more step. Has the price of tomatoes gone down in America because of NAFTA? Do you believe that Walmart, who now buys their tomatoes from Mexico, has said, well, gee, since we can get our tomatoes for half price, let's lower the price by half? Did that happen? Well, not in Springfield, Missouri, not in Ozark County, Missouri. The price of tomatoes are still the same. And the fat cat profiteers that Mr. Bugala is complaining about, these corporate, wicked, evil people, are now making the same amount of money off of the tomatoes, or pricing them at the same price, but they make more profit off of the tomatoes. Do you think minimum wage and free trade are good programs for Americans? I don't deny that they're good programs for Mexicans or Chinese or Indonesians. And God bless them, those Chinese, Mexicans, and Indonesians need to make a living too. But should they make their living at the expense of Americans? I just thought I'd throw that out. Well, we go on. Refusing to raise the state's minimum wage matters, and here's why. Texas workers employed in the service sector, agriculture, and domestic services are covered by the Texas state minimum wage of $3.35 an hour. Well, that means if you bust your butt picking onions in the Rio Grande Valley, or scrubbing floors in Houston, or cleaning toilets for rich people in Bush's Tony neighborhood in Dallas, and you work full-time, 40 hours a week, all year round, you take home the princely sum of, now are you ready for this, boys and girls, the princely sum of $6,700 a year. Now, if those folks are smart and they set aside 15 years' salary, they could be one of Bush's $100,000 donors. And Bush would meet with them, pose for a photo, and do their bidding, just as he does for the fat cats who fund his campaign. Why should W be punished for the lack of foresight, the lack of savings, the lack of civic involvement of these people? If they just play the game according to Bush's rules, I'm sure that he'd support their position. Well, okay, let's think about this for a second. Remember the people in Texas that work at these minimum wage jobs that make the beds in the Holiday Inn and pick the tomatoes and the peppers and whatever they're picking in the Rio Grande Valley, the onions and so on? Well, excuse me, but it was my understanding that these jobs are held by Mexicans. So I suppose we need a minimum wage for Mexicans. Now, down in Mexico, where these people came from, they're working for $2 an hour. And that's why they come to the United States, because they can get $3.35 and then send the surplus back home. And now, the biggest single money generator in the country of Mexico is the money that's being sent back by Mexican workers in the United States working at minimum wage. And I understood, if I understood this correctly, but I've been told that Americans don't want those jobs and won't take them. Americans would rather suck off of welfare than they would to work and to produce at minimum wage. Now, let me ask you this. Why should the government get involved in wages and prices to jack up the price of the produce for the benefit of these Mexicans who come into the country illegally? And they tell me there's 10 to 20 million of them here. I'm just throwing the question out. And I don't blame you Mexicans for coming to the United States. Not at all. If I was living in the kind of poverty that you're in, I'd want to come here too. What I'm asking is, why should the people who own the United States today give it to you? So we Americans are giving our nation away to these illegal immigrants who come here to work for minimum wage, because the minimum wage here is double or triple what they can get where they're at. And the American businesses love it, because the Americans don't want to work at minimum wage. And that's because of the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, which prohibits child labor. Hey, we don't want any of that child labor going on here now, do we? Now, in the old days, when I was a youngster, a kid like me, 15 years old, would go out to some farmer and take a job. My first job was with Frank Rocha at $175 a month in board and room. Yep, slave labor. But, you know, at age 15, I didn't have a trade, I didn't have any experience, didn't have a college degree, and common labor, that is, cleaning the barn and hauling the milk out to the cooler, was about the only kind of grunt work that a 15-year-old pimply-faced punk kid could do. So I did it, and I learned the dairy business. I learned farming. But I didn't stay in the grunt labor all of my life. You know, after I had learned grunt labor, I applied myself and I got to become a milker. And I got a raise. I got $250 a month in board and room. And then I worked real hard and I learned how to farm. And I got another raise. And then I got $300 a month. And then $350. And then I went out and saved some of my money and I went out and then I bought a farm. And I became a farmer. And I became an entrepreneur like Frank Rocha. I became the boss. And then somebody came along and said, oh my God, this is bad. We can't have American children learning how to work. American children should learn how to play video games at the arcade. American children should learn how to play sports after school. They shouldn't work. So we quit doing that. And today you have a whole nation of people that are too damn proud to get off their dead asses and go out and work. Which means that the only people left to do the work are the Mexicans. But I can't for the life of me see why we need to go out and pay the Mexicans a higher wage. Especially since it isn't going to do anything to prices anyway. And if you raise the minimum wage, it will raise the prices. If you lower the cost of production, it won't lower the price of the product. It puts more profit in these very same corporate fat cats' profit pockets. Doesn't look like to me that minimum wage and free trade is going to do anything to the fat cats. And it really doesn't solve the problem of unemployment and laziness in America or the influx of illegal aliens either. Seems like to me that the process and program that our founding fathers gave us from 1787 to about 1950 was a better program. I mean, I just throw it out for your consideration. Well, Mr. Begala goes on, he says, of course, W, being a compassionate conservative, really has the best interest of working folks at heart when he opposes increasing the minimum wage. When he was asked if he supported an increase in the federal minimum wage, Bush said that's up to Congress. I think it's important to do that in certain markets. What I worry about, though, is pricing people out of work. What would folks do with all that extra money if we did raise the minimum wage? Probably just blow it on luxuries like baby food and diapers and rent. W is not like those old Cro-Magnon conservatives who were against the minimum wage because they hated the poor and wanted to keep them desperate so that businesses could exploit them. Bush is against the minimum wage because he loves the poor. Well, hang on a minute. Wait a second here. You know, maybe I'm misunderstanding something. But aren't we importing a lot of goods from China? And these goods that are being imported from China, you know, like shoes, America used to have a shoe industry. Did you know that? Did you know that there used to be a hide industry in the United States and we used to tan a lot of leather here? And did you know we used to have a television industry here in the United States? Yeah, we did, in case you didn't know. Televisions used to be made here. Shoes used to be made here. Steel, a lot of things were made here in America. They're not made here anymore. They're now made in China, South Korea. Now, if we bring in these imports and we sell them in America, isn't it because they're cheaper? Can you tell me how does it benefit the American worker to raise the minimum wage from $5 to $8 an hour when the Chinese laborer is working for 14 to 60 cents an hour? It would seem like to me that if you raised the minimum wage from $5 to $8 an hour, wouldn't that make American products less competitive? And then these very same people that are going to be earning $8 an hour and squandering this excess waste on luxuries like baby food and diapers, as Mr. Bagala points out. Aren't they going to lose their jobs, and aren't their jobs going to be exported overseas? I mean, isn't that what's going on here? Now, in the first 4 years of the Bush years, as I understand it, if I'm reading the newspapers and following along, haven't around 2 million jobs been lost in the United States? I can remember years ago, I'd go over to the hardware store and buy a Stanley tape measure. And it cost me $6 to buy a Stanley tape measure. Made in America. And I never had a complaint about paying $6 for a Stanley tape measure. But one day I went over there, and they had an orange tape measure with a plastic case on it. And it was $2. $2. And I looked at it, and I said, my God, this thing's as good as a Stanley. And then it said, made in China. Now, which tape measure do you think I bought? You guessed it, I bought the orange one, the $2 one from China. In fact, I did one better than that. I bought three of them for the same $6. So instead of buying one American-made Stanley tape measure, I bought three. I squandered my money on luxuries from China. Well, sure enough, you guessed it, a few years later, I saw the Stanley Company remove their plant from Connecticut, and they moved offshore. I think they went to China to manufacture Stanley tools. My God, the outcry from Washington, from the Democrats, was, what a bunch of unpatriotic klutzes these dirty Stanley big cat capitalist corporate thugs are, that they have moved offshore and all of these good folks at Stanley are now unemployed. Well, excuse me, boys and girls. Excuse me. What in the world do you think is going to happen if you raise the minimum wage from $5 to $8 an hour? Honest to God, do you believe that that's going to make us more competitive with 14 to 60 cent an hour labor in China? Well, let's hear it for more free trade. Let's hear it for higher minimum wage. I mean, my God, if unemployment with a minimum wage at $8 an hour is good, wouldn't unemployment at $16 an hour be twice as good? Now, let me tell you, as an old-timey manufacturer, where the bear does it. I'm going to make a certain amount of money. I know I'm an investor. I opened a company up in Idaho one day, and I manufactured furniture for about 6 or 7 years. And I employed 30 people. I produced about $100,000 worth of furniture a month. That's $1 million a year. I paid about $200,000 a year in taxes, and I made about $100,000 a year. I employed 30 people. Those 30 people were making minimum wage, or a little more in some cases. And those people that were making minimum wage and that were making a little more were paying their rent. They were productive people. They paid their taxes. They bought gasoline, and they did all those things that people do when they're employed. People that went from minimum wage to a little more are people who could produce more. I had people in there that were making $20 an hour. Piece rate. You get paid for what you produce. The more you produce, the more you get paid. Some jobs are minimum wage. Now, I had problems with OSHA, the EPA, and all of the governmental regulatory agencies, and one day I woke up and I said, the government out of this operation gets $200,000 a year and I get $100,000. The government produces nothing and gets paid twice as much as I do. And on top of that, they send their agents in here to get in my way. You know, I probably could have put up with that if the government agents had just gotten the hell out of the road. But they don't. They not only take twice as much as I make, but they get in the way of me making it. And I said, well, the day's coming when I'm going to stop doing this. Well, the other day, George Bush suggested that we have some tax cuts. I took a look at the capital gain tax cuts, and I said to my wife, you know, this guy Bush almost persuades me to go back into business. So in 1981, I closed that business. And those 30 people were then left unemployed. And I want to point out to you boys and girls that 65% of all of the employment in America, 65% is in little small businesses that have less than 100 employees. 10% of the employment in America is by government. 25% of the employment in America is by corporations. When you drive the little businesses out of business, what you will have left is 25 and 10. That's 35% of the employment by big business and government. Is that what you want? Because that's where we're headed. You're driving the little businesses out of business with government wage and price controls, OSHA, the EPA, and regulation. Well, you drove me out of business, Paul. Now, you can sit there and say, well, that's too bad for you. No, Paul. No, no. Wait a minute. Let me tell you how I live, Paul. Now, I'm an entrepreneur, and I live on a farm. Up in my refrigerator, I have 1 gallon of Jersey cream. I keep a gallon of cream in my refrigerator at all times. Now go look in your refrigerator, Paul, and how much cream do you have? Last time you saw cream was at Thanksgiving, when your wife went out and bought a cup of it and whipped it and put it on your pumpkin pie. I told my daughter, I said, "Po' folk, don't eat cream." My daughter eats cream on her Rice Krispies. My standard of living hasn't gone down. I eat meat as often as I want. I have my own cow. I have plenty of meat, milk, butter, and eggs. I produce it all. My standard of living isn't less, it's better. And I'm doing it with 30 less employees, Paul. 30 fewer employees. Don't you believe for a minute that Donald Trump is going to go hungry because the minimum wage goes up? Anybody who's an entrepreneur who goes out and works and makes money is going to work and make money. That's because work produces wealth. Idleness produces poverty. I can't for the life of me see how unemployment at $16 an hour or unemployment at $8 an hour can benefit the poor. It would look like to me that $6,700 a year is better than nothing. When I was 15 and getting $175 a month, Paul, I thought that was better than nothing, which is what American teenagers are working for now. After school, they go play games. They're not working. They're not productive. And then they join gangs and they get real destructive. I think that the old system was better than what we've replaced it with. I don't think that replacing work and education for young people with minimum wage and child labor laws has advanced America one iota. I think that it's a big giant step backwards. Now, I'm in a minority, and I'll admit that. I'm probably the only guy in America that subscribes to this, but I just thought I'd tell you from my viewpoint, my point of view. I'm not going to go back into business and employ 30 people until the Department of Labor and the regulations and the restrictions change. I wouldn't mind going to China and opening a business, because that's where free enterprise works its best. Today, those dirty communist Chinese, with an economy growing at 7% a year, without regulation, full employment. Hey, I think that's a great place. And we used to have that in America, and we don't anymore. And I suggest that we just take a look at what it was we were doing in 1890. Compare that to what we're doing in 1990, and then say, gee, if we went back to the same policies that we had 100 years ago, would it increase employment? Would it increase our tax base? Would it increase our standard of living? And then, you know, you take it from there. But I don't think I'm going to criticize George Bush because he's opposed to the minimum wage, because I'm opposed to it, too. All right, now our friend Paul goes on. He says, of course, W, being a compassionate conservative, really has the best interests of working folks at heart when he opposes increasing the minimum wage. When he was asked if he supported an increase in the federal minimum wage, Bush said that's up to Congress. And then he goes on to say, it's just that sometimes you have to hurt the ones you love. Abraham Lincoln, a Republican who truly did care about the poor, once said, the good Lord must have loved common people. He made so many of them. And the Lord certainly placed a lot of hard-working minimum wage earning folks in Texas. It was the second highest number of workers, more than 1 million, who would benefit from an increase in the federal minimum wage. To be precise, Texas has 1 million workers who could have used the raise, second only to California. I don't know about you, but if Texas had more than 1 million billionaires who wanted to line their pockets with another outrageous Bush special interest tax cut, I have a feeling I know where Bush would be. Now, let me tell you something about this tax cut. You know, just from a businessman's point of view, I don't think liberals and Democrats understand taxes and tax cuts. Now, I'm not a Republican, so don't get mad at me. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a communist or a socialist. I'm just a businessman. Let me tell you what happens here. Let's suppose, in my little neck of the woods, this happened to us up at the Atlantis Company in Boise, Idaho. The state legislature raised the corporate income tax by 5%. Now, as a businessman, I'm sitting here saying, okay, well, the state has raised the corporate income tax by 5%, so I raised my prices by 5%. And so did every other corporation in Idaho. We raised our tax, we raised our prices 5% to compensate for the taxes that had been raised 5%. Can you tell me how that benefited the poor people earning minimum wage? I'll tell you, boys and girls, it not only didn't help them, it hurt them. Tax increases and taxes in general hurt the poor more than the wealthy. I was never harmed by one penny from that tax increase. Never cost me a cent. But it cost the poor, everybody who bought my products, much more than 5%. Because you see, my 5% corporate tax was 5% of 100,000, but I raised my prices across the board 5% of what I was selling. That's 1,200,000. So while my 5% amounted to 5,000, I raised my prices 5% on $1,000,000. So I raised my prices $50,000. Well, my taxes went up 5, and so did every other corporation in the state. Can you tell me how that benefited the poor? Now, on the other hand, George Bush comes along and says, well, let's cut taxes. Now, when you cut taxes 5%, and you leave that $5,000 in my pocket, did you think that I was going to go up and put 2 gallons of cream in my refrigerator, or go out and put another freezer in and fill it with beef? No. No. Entrepreneurs, when they get a tax cut, they go out and invest the money in making some kind of new business enterprise. Well, when you cut taxes, I don't raise prices. When you cut taxes, you put more money in my pocket. You give Donald Trump $50,000, and Donald Trump is not going to go out and spend that money on a new Mercedes. Donald Trump is going to go out and buy a new building and renovate it. Donald Trump is going to invest that in some kind of a product, some kind of a process, something that makes him more money. All of us entrepreneurs are that way. I've never met one yet that had enough money. I once had a guy tell me that I charged too much for my schools, and I said, well, how much is enough? He didn't know. Neither did I. I don't know how much money is enough. I have never talked to anybody who had enough money. I have yet to meet anybody who ever walked up to me and said, wait a minute, hold it right there. I've got too much money. And I want to buy this from you, and I want to pay you twice as much because I got more money and I know what to do with. I've never seen that. Nor have I seen anybody retire and tell me that he had more than enough money. Everybody tells me, I don't know how I'm going to get by. I don't know how I'm going to make the next month's rent payment. I think everybody's just about the same. The difference is, when you give the money to the poor guy, it increases his standard of living temporarily. Temporarily. He feels real good. God, I got another dollar an hour. And he goes out and he buys cigarettes and booze, and he lives a little better until the prices hit him. My God, folks, cigarettes used to be 30 cents a pack. The poorest people in the nation smoke cigarettes. Today they're $3 a pack. Headed for 30. You know, if you think inflation's good, raise taxes. Raise the minimum wage. Makes people feel good, but in the long run, that isn't where reality meets the road. Now he says, Bush here, he says he may not like working people, but he sure likes their funds. In the 1999 legislative session, Bush called for legislation to take $400 million out of the Texas Workers' Compensation Fund and to place it in the state's general revenue fund, where it could be used for, you guessed it, tax breaks for the more affluent. I gotta hand it to W. At least he's consistent. Well, back in 1994, when he was running for governor, W. pledged to protect the state's teacher retirement fund from a similar raid. And I will oppose any effort to reduce contributions to the teacher retirement system or to decrease the state's contribution rate. That's Bush's 1994 campaign literature, and that's what it said. Oops. In 1995, Bush cut $400 million in funding from the teachers' retirement system, reducing the state contribution from 7.31% to 6%. Perhaps recalling the joy of those college panty raids, W. went back for one more raid on the teachers' retirement system. In 1997, he tried to take $47 million from the teachers' pension fund and use it to pay for administrative costs that had heretofore been paid from general revenue. The teachers, bless their little hearts, didn't like this. We opposed the governor's raid of the $47 million in the teachers' retirement fund, said Texas State Teachers Association President Richard Curry. This is money that could be used to enhance the benefits of retirees or to enhance the benefits of active teachers. Bush didn't care. If you could read his mind at the time, he was probably thinking, so what if the teachers are mad? What do they know? They never ran a baseball team. They never worked in the oil business. If they're so damn smart, then they'd be governor, wouldn't they? So Bush wanted to free up the $47 million in administrative costs for, if you're playing along at home, you already know the answer, tax cuts for the more affluent. God, I love this guy's consistency. Well, I agree with you, Paul. If George Bush said, I will not raise these taxes, or if George Bush said, I will not take a penny out of the teacher's retirement fund, or I will not mess with this money that belongs to the teachers, I think he's dead wrong. I think that's bad. I think that's wrong. I don't think Bush should do that. And thank you for reminding me of what he did. After all, God told us in Numbers chapter 30 that what comes out of a man's mouth is his bond. And I agree with you. I've heard George Bush make some comments like that and make some statements, and then he didn't follow through. I'm not a George Bush fan. I'm not too enthralled with George Bush's $2.5 trillion budget. And there's a lot of things that's bad about George Bush. And that may be one of them. But Paul, while you're talking about teachers and how we could take that money and pay more teachers' retirement funds and pay active teachers, let me tell you a little story about the teachers down in Texas. I'm going to quote to you from America to Pray or Not to Pray by David Barton. He's a radical, right-wing, rabid, conservative, lunatic fringe. Here's his report, page 66. He says, teacher competency testing. These are the same teachers that you want to make sure get all this money. He said, with the growing awareness of poor student performance, attention has begun to focus not only on the educational system in general, but on teachers in particular. Features such as the Dallas Times Herald special report in December of 1983 can be found in most major newspapers across the country. Notice these highlights. 20 states have acted to stem the flow of teachers who cannot spell, add, or punctuate by requiring competency testing for teachers. When the test was given last April to 1,269 juniors in the Texas teacher education programs, 38% failed the exam, which tests basic skills taught by the 12th grade, such as calculating percentages, capitalizing words, and comprehending a 200-word passage. The test was also given to 3,300 new teachers in the Houston Independent School District. Because of cheating, did you get that? Because of cheating and other irregularities, scores for only 2,400 of the teachers were reported. Almost two-thirds, 62%, failed the exam. The Houston School Board later lowered the passing score so that only 44% of the teachers failed. Dallas school officials say that on the same test, 1,223 of the 2,280 teachers hired by the Dallas School District since 1979, 54%, could not correctly answer 67% of the questions. Now I'm going to pause right there. I agree with you, Paul, that George Bush is not doing his job when it comes to education and teachers in Texas. But I don't think it has anything to do with the teacher's retirement fund. I think it's his incompetence in correcting a deficiency in which 54% of the teachers in Dallas couldn't answer 67% of the questions on a test. Boys and girls, these people, these teachers, the teacher who's teaching your child in your public school has a degree from college. And then they have a teaching credential on top of it. And of the 3,300 new teachers in the Houston Independent School District, because of cheating, 900 couldn't even take the test. They had to throw it out because they were cheating. That is, your teachers are cheating on their own tests. Mr. Bogalla, you're exactly right. That George Bush is an incompetent twit, a nincompoop, to allow that kind of crap to go on in the Texas school system. And so are all of the politicians that are in Texas, to allow that to happen. Now, I'm just a businessman, but when I saw that, I said to myself, well, I don't think I want to send my child to the public school, and I didn't. I don't know of anybody. I have never met a businessman in my life that would put up with that kind of crap in his business. Now, if George Bush didn't fix that while he was governor, he's an incompetent twerp, a nitwit, a nincompoop, to run the government, to run a business, and to allow that kind of incompetence to occur. If I had a manager in a business, a factory, a store, a branch, that showed that kind of incompetence, I'd fire the nitwit. And so would any other businessman. But I don't think that that's unusual just to Texas. I think that's going on in California and New York and Florida. I think that's going on all over America. So to single George Bush out and say that he's a dirty, no good, low-down so-and-so because he's screwing over these teachers, let me ask you this, Paul. Let's take these same teachers and let's double their salaries, shall we? Well, I don't care, whatever they're making. The same people we're just talking about. These 1,223 teachers, 54% of the teachers who couldn't answer 67% of the questions, let's double their damn pay. Honest to God, are you going to come back and tell me that'll make them competent? The reason that they're incompetent is because they're underpaid. But if you double their salaries, all of a sudden they'll become real competent. They'll be able to spell and add and subtract and capitalize and comprehend a 200-word passage if you just double their pay. I tell you, boys and girls, we Americans have just gone plain nuts. We're suffering from the terminal stupids over here. My God, no wonder the Chinese are taking over the world. They get up in the morning and they go to work. Our children don't get up in the morning and go to work. They go to public school to learn from teachers with degrees and teaching credentials who cheat themselves, and then they teach your children morality. My God. And then he goes on with the anti-union label. I agree with you, Paul. George Bush's word should be good. So should Bill Clinton's word be good. And what the President of the United States says, he ought to back up with deeds. I think the President ought to be moral. I think he ought to be honest. I think Abraham Lincoln was pretty honest and pretty moral. I think Andrew Jackson was pretty honest and pretty moral. I think George Washington was pretty honest and pretty moral. What do you think of Bill Clinton? Do you think he was honest? Do you think he was moral? I think Jimmy Carter was pretty honest and pretty moral. He always struck me as being a pretty decent person. I like Jimmy Carter. I thought Dwight Eisenhower was a pretty honest and moral man. Oh, they might have had some failings and flaws. And, you know, maybe they weren't as honest as they could have been, and maybe they were on the take from time to time. But, you know, as a general rule, I think they were pretty good guys. But I think, too, that if we're going to criticize George Bush, I think we should criticize him for the things that are really of substance. Yeah, it's a good point. If he gave the word, if his campaign literature said, I'm not going to touch those funds, by God, he shouldn't touch them. That's wrong. But if he didn't straighten out that crazy mess down there in Texas while he was governor, isn't that worse? I know. I'll just leave it up to you. We'll take it up right here next time when we come back. I'm out of time, so let me close the program and tell you where you're going and where we're going. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. The Law Hour webpage is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Hey, I'm out of time. The signal's on. I gotta leave. We'll see you here back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.